The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this, the 22nd day of March in 2026. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us, keeping us on the straight and narrow as usual. Glad you're here with us tonight, wherever you may be. Of course, via the free TuneIn app, we are available everywhere. So we got a tremendous show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the legendary shortstop for some really great New York Yankee ball clubs. Tony Kubek will join us. Up next, we will welcome in the great bullpen ace from the 1986 world champion New York Mets, Roger McDowell, and we'll discuss his new book, and Doug Feldman, Roger's co-author, will be with us to chat as well. In the 9 o'clock hour, a very special guest joins us, appearing at the Gateway Playhouse out in Bellport in a hilarious iteration of the Full Monty. The legendary Sally Struthers will chat with us. Finally, last but not least, a man who has won Olympic gold in men's basketball. He's backed up Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain. Really, he had a great shot for a seven-footer. Mel Counts will join us. So we have for you tonight a two-time Emmy winner, a couple of world champions, and a gold medal winner. So it's like a veritable murderer's row of a lineup tonight, folks. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Got some great sports talk waiting for you up ahead. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page, which is called The Talk of New York Sports. Sports information, show information, so much more out there. So stop by, take a look. You can also follow me on X at B Donahue WGBB. That's all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all out on the website the next day, and you can listen to them whenever your heart desires. So our first guest, during his nine-year playing career with the New York Yankees, he played in six World Series, starting in 37 World Series games. He was the 1957 American League Rookie of the Year, a four-time All-Star, three-time World Series champion. And for NBC television, he later broadcast 12 World Series and 14 League Championship Series. He received the Ford Frick Award for baseball broadcasting in 2009. It's a real honor to welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Tony Kubek. Tony, good evening.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it. You know, it's interesting.
Go ahead,
when you were
Tony.
Doing your intro, you mentioned all the names that are on your show over the next couple of hours, and you used a phrase called veritable murderer's row.
Yeah.
May I tell a little story about my baseball heritage?
Go ahead.
Okay, my dad played professional baseball and went up to the AAA level.
Right.
He played with the old Milwaukee Brewers in the American Association in 1931.
Mm-hmm.
In 1931, the Yankees, with seven future Hall of Famers, to help out a minor league franchise, the Milwaukee Brewers, AAA Milwaukee Brewers, the Yankees played a game in Yankee Stadium, took a train, got off, had their uniforms on, played an exhibition game to draw some money for the Milwaukee Brewers, and my dad was a member of that team. And the Yankee team had guys like Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Bill Dickey, Lazeri, Frankie Frassetti, who was our coach for a long time with the Yankees when I played for them.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom kept a scrapbook and has got pictures of that incident where the game was 9-9. The Yankees had a game in White City, Chicago the next day. They were there in Milwaukee on their off day. Ruth let a ball go through his leg to first base. The manager played him at first base so he could be closer to the fans and put the Iron Horse, Lou Gehrig, out in the outfield. My dad tells the story. Ruth let a baseball go through his leg, ran off the field, doffed his cap, and said, "We got to go. We got a doubleheader in Chicago against the White Sox tomorrow." and trains don't wait for anybody, even the Yankees. So my dad was on the ball club for that Milwaukee Brewers, that AAA club that played against one of the greatest teams ever assembled. And that's my murderer's row story.
What a wonderful story, Tony. Oh, man. And your mom had pictures of it.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. She was keeping scrapbooks. My mother was born in Poland. Mm-hmm. She came over. Her dad came over first from Poland because there were conditions to work just before the First World War in Poland. And so my mom came with her mom 2 years later, settled in Milwaukee, and she claims she actually, and I believe her, she actually kept scrapbooks after they got married. My dad came home from a ball game one day when he played, a day game, of course. There were no lights at the ballpark in that day and age. And he found who became his wife. My mother was his girlfriend at the time, and her five siblings, and they were going to put them all in the orphanage. And as my mom tells the story, she said, my dad said, who are these? And the people who were taken from social services, put them in the orphanage. My dad said, okay, let's get married. So they got married, kept all the kids, and it became a real baseball family because all of them, in one way or another, were connected with baseball. My mother kept a scrapbook, and she said it's how she learned to speak English, keeping track of her Milwaukee Brewers and her husband at that time, my father, Tony Sr.
Amazing story, Tony. Wow, that is something else. Boy, oh boy. I got to ask you, Tony, about your infield. We talked on the phone about your double play partner, Bobby Richardson. You had Cletus Boyer at third base. Tell us a little bit about that infield.
Well, I think Cleet, obviously, is Brother Kenny, and he was from a family of about 13 kids, I think, with three, or was it four, who made the big leagues for a little while. But Cleet was just a terrific third base with a great throwing arm. He could have played shortstop, but I was at that position at the time, and that's where Ralph Houck in that 61 team wanted me to be. And Bobby was exceptional. He didn't just have a great World Series game where he got the MVP, the only guy to get the MVP from a losing team. Mm-hmm. But he was a great key man. He never missed an inning. He was so durable. He made the double play. He learned that from Jerry Coleman, who was before him at second base. And when Jerry was in Korea, Bobby got his chance to play and made the best of it, made some All-Star games. Moose Gowan played first base, and later on we had a Joe Pepitone, who also was a great infielder. But I think that was the key, and is usually the key to a lot of baseball clubs. If you got a good, solid defense, I mean, errors do mean something, but if you play the game right, you position yourself right, and understand what's going on with the other team and how to play hitters, you can play in the big leagues. But Moose was a pretty good first baseman. Mm-hmm. I mean, Moose on that ball club was not only an offensive player, he was a good athlete. He was a punter for Purdue University at one time when he had the Big Ten record for the longest punt. And Moose could run, and he hit 300 how many times? Five, six times. And he would hit sometimes seventh on that ball club. The infield was good. And, of course, then when Roger came along, Maris in right field, Mickey in center field, and Tommy Tress was moved to the outfield. For a few years, that may have been one of the best outfields ever in baseball. They could throw, they could chase the ball down, and you had to be able to do that spacious Yankee Stadium in center field and left and right center field. So it was a good team. It was a fundamentally sound team, and I think good base runners and had a really good knowledge of the game. Allie Howard took Yogi's place. Finally, in 63, he got to play regularly as a catcher, and he was MVP that year and hit over 300. Terrific player, but he was behind Yogi, so he played some left field, some first base, but he was a very versatile athlete, too. I think we played the game right. I remember Billy Fisher was a relief pitcher, a sinker baller for Kansas City and some other clubs, and he said one time they're like a carpet sweeper. They sweep up everything inside, and they never let a ball get through. So I think we were proud of our defense.
Yes.
We worked at it very hard. And that was a tribute, I think, to Frank Cassetti, who I mentioned earlier. Frank Cassetti played with those great roof teams. He was there when the Phantom called shot, which was not a called shot. Cassetti said the Babe didn't call that thing, although it's still, it's still kind of a legendary, that he was.
Right.
It was a team that knew how to play the game right. Because in 61, when that team was at its peak, I mean, the Detroit Tigers had a terrific team, there too. And, some of the guys they had on that ball club, with K-Line and Cash and some of the other guys. They were good, and they actually scored more runs than we did that year. But we led the league in home runs and set a record without a DH, which has since been broken. And also, we had a good pitching staff. You just weren't going to go to losing streak when you had Whitey Ford on your staff. I mean, Whitey would stop any two-game losing streak. Johnny Fain became the pitching coach. He pitched Whitey Ford a little less between starts. And then we had Louis Arroyo come along from Puerto Rico, and he just had a great year in relief. And Baltimore actually had the best ERA in the league because he had a lot of good young pitchers. But I think overall, the defense and the offense and the understanding of how to play the game made us a little bit better ball club than those other two clubs.
Like you say, Tony, strong up the middle. That was the 61 Yankees, that's for sure. And we talk about the old Crow. I tell my Yankee fan friends, that's your original number two right there is the old Crow, Frank Crisetti. I remember that's what the Scooter used to call him when he was in the broadcast booth, the old Crow, down at coach of third base, Frank Crisetti. And that is definitely true, Tony. Tony Kubek's with us tonight on the program. Now, we spoke about the 61 Yankees, Tony. How did you get into broadcasting, and did anybody along the way influence your style?
No, I got into broadcasting a stroke of good luck, I guess you'd say. I had an injury from when I was in the military and had some problems with my neck, and I was starting to struggle at the bat the last couple of years, and decided that I couldn't protect the doctors, but they were coming. Said, you got to be careful. The main thing he told us, don't let the kids jump over your head. We had two young boys at the time, so I had to be careful. Mm-hmm. And then NBC got the package, and I was in a bar restaurant that Phil Lynch and a fellow from Mr. Laughs, it was called. It was a very popular place. And I went in to tell Phil that, say goodbye to him and some of the other players that were in the bar restaurant at the time. And a fellow came up to me and introduced himself, David Kennedy, who happened to be the son of a legendary basketball president of the NBA, his father. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm not sure. They want me maybe to go to the minor leagues and maybe take a job as a manager or get a coaching job and stay in baseball. But then after I met David Kennedy, a fellow from NBC, Chet Simmons, called me and said, what are you going to do? I said, not sure. He said, well, but we're looking for a broadcaster. We've got Kurt Gowdy going to be a play-by-play guy, and we've got some backup guys and stuff, and we'd like to try you out for 6 weeks. If you like us and, you know, we like you stuff, we'd give you a job. Well, after about six games, I signed a three-year contract and ended up lasting 24 years. Didn't have any interest in broadcasting. I didn't know anything about it. But Chet Simmons, I'll never forget the first game I did, the backup game. We were in Pittsburgh and so forth, and I was working with Jim Simpson, and all of a sudden we had a little rain delay, and they came to our ball game. And I remember the director, Teddy Nathanson, said, when you didn't speak at all in the meeting that first day before you went off to Pittsburgh, I wasn't so sure you could even talk. And I said, well, it was of necessity. I had to get a job, and it was a terrific offer, and ended up with NBC for 24 years. And that's great partners. I mean, not just Kurt. I mean, Joe Garagiola for a bunch of years, and Bob Costas came along. He swears I broke him in. Nobody could break him in. He was he was a wizard himself, you know, the knowledge and doing baseball and love for the game. So I was able to stay in baseball, which was so good for me, as it was for my father, even though he didn't make the major leagues. And the opportunity was there, and I got to survive for quite a while. At all. I often marvel just when I finally did get broadcast, I look at some of the guys that were still playing, Willie Mays and Clemente and Marichal and Spahn and a lot of Hall of Famers and stuff. And sometimes they said to me, what am I doing on the field with these same guys? But I think with the Yankees, the way they traded, the way they groomed their players, I got with the right organization. And just the organization, my father wanted to be with. You know, he knew that Phil Rizzuto was done after 56 seasons and so forth. And it was the time for me to get moved up. And I never forget when we left spring training that year in 57, Casey took me along for one game to sit and watch an exhibition game at Ebbets Field. He said, I wanted you to see Ebbets Field. And then along the way at that spring training, we did some railroad trips up north and he put me in the outfield in New Orleans, Louisiana. We were playing an exhibition game in a minor league ballpark. Put me in, he said, go in for Mickey. He said, we're going to take him out after 5 innings. And I made a decent catch, and then I made a decent throw. And I think that helped me come along with the team in 57 and so forth, because Casey, you know, if Mickey got hurt, he could throw me out in center field. And interestingly enough, in the 57 series against the Braves, you had Aaron and Matthews and Spahn and Shane Neese. I never played shortstop. I played third base. I played center field because Mickey got hurt for a few games, and left field. So Casey, I was versatile enough to handle that and not hurt the team. So I think the versatility helped me a little bit.
The great Tony Kubek with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, I remember you, Tony, in the 69 series. You were roving in the stands. You had the headset on, and Kurt and Lindsey Nelson were up in the booth, and I remember you talking to Casey was in the stands. Pearl Bailey was in the stands, probably Nancy Seaver too. But you were one of the first guys to be called an analyst. Now, they had color commentators in the booth, but you were like the first analyst. And later came guys like Tim McCarver, Jim Cott, who really served well in that role as a baseball analyst.
Well, I don't know what an analyst means. I mean, you're looking at, now I think it would be apropos because of all the analytics in baseball.
Right.
And the numbers that are all over the place and the study defenses. And I used to have talked to late Frank Howard a lot. And he said, I've talked to a couple of managers with this analytics stuff. And he said, they don't even make up the lineup. It's made up before they even get to the ballpark. And he said, in a way you might say the game's getting a little bit too dehumanized. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind change at all. I mean, I was opposed to DH. I always thought that the DH kind of, if baseball is a game of inches, as they say, and close calls and, you know, one little thing can make a difference. I think if you get two great pitchers on the mound and it may be a low scoring ball game, but the guy maybe can get up at the plate and hit a little bit, might have a little bit of edge. And in a baseball, like a lot of sports, is this kind of game that a little bit of edge can mean the difference between losing or winning. So I don't know what analyst means and stuff. It means taking the numbers out. I just enjoyed the way the pace of the game. And, you know, now I see with time clocks and all this other stuff, I'm not so sure the pacing of the game is good. Plus, it's expensive that it is to get to the ballpark. A lot of grandpas and fathers want to take their kids. They can hardly afford to see more than a game in a year. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot has got to do with the money, whether it's on either side. I don't want to begrudge 1 cent that other players are making, because I know what we were making when you couldn't get out of an argument. I signed in Chicago. My dad and I drove down, and it was drove us down to Chicago from Milwaukee, where I grew up. And I sat Casey Stengel and so forth and everything. He talked to me a little bit. We got signed down there, and my dad had signed the contract because I was only 17 years of age. Went out and played 3 years in the minor leagues, and next thing you know, Casey's got me jumping around to different positions, and, you know, there are a lot of young players. By the last couple of days of spring training in St. Petersburg, Florida, I've got a picture somewhere in the scrapbook where they had somebody asked Casey, who's going to play shortstop since Rizzuto, you know, was let go in 56.
Right.
And he said, one of these guys, and there were 12 guys lining up. And I didn't start at shortstop that day, but Casey put me all over places. I spent more time trying to figure out where I was going to play that, you know, that particular day and what position and the batting practice. So I could go practice that position for that day's ball game. But it helped me stay on the field, and I appreciate it.
Well, you also worked local telecasts for the Toronto Blue Jays. In fact, you were the first guy to win Ford Frick, who did Canadian baseball. I believe it was in their inaugural season of 1977 through 89. But you were noted for you really educated the Canadian baseball fans on the sport, without really being condescending or simplistic about it. You just went about it your own way.
Well, you know, they had good minor league teams up there in Montreal and in Toronto. I remember when Allie Howard, I got the job, and then I talked to Sparky Anderson. So you're going to a great baseball. They understand baseball. So I don't know if I taught anybody anything about baseball up there, but it was a good opportunity. Peter Bavese was there, and he called me and said, you're going to have some time off now that ABC's got part of the baseball contract. Would you be interested? And they did Hockey Night in Canada on Wednesday nights. So it started off small scale. I was gradually went into Sunday, so I had allowed travel time getting from the game in the week on Saturday to the Sunday game in Toronto. But it was a great town, and enjoyed it. I had a chance to see all the great players that started coming up, whether it was Bell or Griffin or Fernandez, Donaldson Garcia, and some of the others. In fact, the president of the Dominican Republic, El Presidente, he invited me and took the whole family and paid for us to come down to the Dominican Republic. So we went down there twice. My wife and I went once. We took our four kids after one Christmas. Went down there. It's just magnificent facilities that were going up by every team so they could have the edge on the Dominican Republic of baseball players there. But they played baseball 365 days a year. You see some of the strong arms in baseball now, and a lot of the kids from the islands, they throw 365 days a year. Yeah. Whitey Herzog used to say, why are there so many sore arms and legs with so many injuries? It's because the guys don't throw enough. Throw enough in the Dominican Republic. And I wanted to go from kids and just blossom into just really terrific players. Oh, yeah. So it was good. I enjoyed being down there. But, lucky I spent 13 years in Toronto. Got to know a lot of people. Still have a lot of friends. And if I weren't pulling so hard for the Yankees to win, even now that I'm not connected with them, I'd probably be hoping that Toronto would win it because they're a good franchise. Good
sure.
People.
Tony Kubek with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, you were known for speaking your mind, Tony. You weren't afraid to say it as it was, as Howard Cosell put it so many times. One of the things you spoke about was when Hank Aaron hit his 715th career home run. You called that game, I believe, with Kurt Gowdy and Joe Garagiola. You criticized Bowie Kuhn for not being there, and I'm inclined to agree with you.
Well, it was a mistake. He should have gone. I would say that he didn't know how important it was. He was a good football fan, but, again, he made a decision that wasn't the right one. I was also accused of getting on George Steinbrenner too much by George Steinbrenner himself, who went more than one time when I was working at Madison Square Garden the last broadcasting that I did in baseball. Bob Gutkowski was a dear friend and was president at Madison Square Garden. He said, I get a call from Steinberg today about something you said. And then Jeff Idelson, who was the PR director at the time and went to the Hall of Fame and ran that for a while, he said George hired two college kids just to look at every tape of every Yankee game that I broadcast and find something that I bad about him. And Jeff said the kids couldn't find anything bad about they're talking about charge, but that's water over the dam. I think, maybe I was too impetuous at times and letting things get out of hand. I just tried to be fair. That was the only thing. One thing that Chet Simmons wrote us and called me before the first game I telecast, about 2 hours before that game in Pittsburgh, I mentioned earlier, he said, Tony, I just want to say one thing to you. Whatever comes out of your mouth, you are responsible for. And I always stuck with me. And I think it keeps a little rope around a guy if he wants to go a little too far. But, what I saw, I talked about it and something and I could legitimately track it down, it would go on the air. There were some times where I just think that I had to be careful that I didn't say because it was confidential stuff. But I had a good time. I rode the coattails and when I was playing on the Mantles and the Barons and the Whitey Fours, and I went on the coattails of Kirk Gowdy and Joe Garagiola and Bob Costas along the way, and always enjoyed being in the booth, but more so just grateful for what baseball did for me and did for my family and so forth. And I'll never regret having taken that broadcaster's job.
Not at all. You ended the career before retirement with MSG doing the Yankee games.
Yeah. I had a good boss there, Bob Gutkowski, and did about a little over 100 games, and I enjoyed that. The only thing about it is I wish I could have, when I was doing the game of the week, I saw a lot of National League teams and American teams. And when you're just doing one league, I kind of missed bulks and packs from the National League to the American League, a little different styles of play, different players and different Hall of Famers, like, you know, Henry Aaron, Frank Robinson, and on and on and on. So, yeah. But it was good. I had a good job at Madison Square Garden. And the fans were always good. The letters I'd get that they were grateful that, you know, I might add something to a game. But I always thought the game was the most important thing. I still do. And if a broadcaster goes away from that and it tries to be cute or something else, I don't think that's the way to do a game. Mm-hmm. It'll stick going on the field. So there isn't anything live except poor news around these days, except baseball on the agenda within the next week or so, playing for real.
Right. Yeah, and that's 100% true, Tony. And I just want to thank you because, as you say, the game of the week was probably the only exposure a kid back then got to out-of-market players like a Harmon Killebrew or an Al Kaline or a Willie Mays.
Oh, sure.
And it was thanks to you, Kurt Gowdy, Joe, and folks like you guys that really brought these guys into our living rooms and gave the kids a taste of what it's like outside New York.
Yeah. Can I get a free plug-in for something?
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Well, you mentioned Rogers doing a book coming out.
Right.
I had a book published several months ago. It's not a baseball book. I sat down there and I was kind of looking for something to do, and I started thinking of things way back in my childhood, and so I sat down and wrote a historical fiction novel. I had about 800 pages written and finally got it narrowed down to about 450. It was published through Kindle Direct Publishing. It's called And the Game Played On. And the game I'm talking about in the book is baseball, although most of the stuff is historical about Hiroshima, the dropping of the bomb and the manufacture of the bomb and lasers and some of the other things, the Posse Comitatus and so forth that are anti-establishment, anti-government people. So I got that in print, published it myself. I was lucky my daughter's got her doctorate in English, so she did the editing. And it's on the market. And the game I'm talking about is baseball. And what I did was I just used some epigraphs in sections that are baseball. For instance, the first one would be Messerschmitt was born on the day the first atomic bomb was detonated. Mm-hmm. Not the one in Hiroshima, the one in Los Alamos and so forth. So he and Dave McNally, who changed the game when they went to arbitration and got rid of the reserve clause, that's the first epigraph of the baseball. And throughout, periodically, I put some other baseball incidents in connection with world history into the novel. So, yeah, I had fun doing it. I was looking for an extra project and was a little too brave to try to do it myself, but I got it all done.
Interesting, Tony. We'll have the folks check that out and the game played on by Tony Kubek, folks. It's out there. Look for it. Find it. Read it. I'm sure it's a wonderful read. Tony, it's been an honor and a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to spend it with us back here in Sports Talk New York. I wish all the best to you, all the best to your family, and again, we appreciate you coming on with us.
Bill, thanks for having me, and it sounds like you got a great show coming up, and I hope the people stick with you.
Thank you, Tony.
To you and the great guests that you've got. Take care.
Thanks again, Tony. The great Tony Kubek, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in the notorious second spinner, Roger McDowell. Stick around, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we are back. We're back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB, AM/FM radio, live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York, USA. I hope everyone is well. I hope you're enjoying the program tonight. While we're waiting for Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman, I just want to reiterate Tony Kubek. What a career the guy had. Winning the Ford Frick Award for Excellence in Baseball Broadcasting. And he was the first Frick Award winner whose baseball career was based solely on television, too. The other guys were in the era of radio. Tony was the first guy who basically spent all his career on TV. And that's what he won the Ford Frick Award for. And he was the first to win that award to have called games for a Canadian team for the Toronto Blue Jays from 1977 to 1989. Well, our next guest, he teamed with Jesse Orosco to form a formidable lefty-righty tandem working out of the bullpen for the 1986 World Champion New York Mets. He and his co-author, who was here tonight as well, have written a new book from our friends in Chicago, Triumph Books. The book is titled Hot Foot, My Hijinks and Upside-Down Life with the 1986 World Champion New York Mets. I welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, Bill. How's it going?
Wonderful. Hey, wonderful. Glad to have you guys aboard. Now, I just want to ask you, Roger, growing up in Ohio, who were your sports heroes and teams when you were a kid?
What sport?
Any you want to give us, all of them, if you want. That's
well,
fine.
When I was a youngster, the Big Red Machine was in Cincinnati. As it's in the book, as I was a Dodger fan, my dad was a big Dodger fan, and at the time, the Dodgers were in the same division as the Reds, Braves, and they were in the National League West at the time, and
right.
There were the few teams in the National West, the three in California and Cincinnati and Atlanta, but yeah, my dad was a big Dodger fan, so I was a big Dodger fan, a lot because of Sandy Koufax, Don Drysdale. Johnny Padres, who later became, well, both him and Ron Paranowski became pitching coaches for me. Pods was the pitching coach when I was in Philadelphia, and Perry was the pitching coach when I was with the Dodgers. So I got to meet my heroes, and obviously Sandy was around at Vero Beach a lot, so got to see him. But it was a basketball, it was probably the Cincinnati Royals, which was the Cincinnati ball club in the NBA at the time, and Nate Archibald, Oscar Robertson, those players that played for the Royals. And football is a Miami Dolphin fan. I loved Paul Warfield.
Number 42, Paul Warfield. Yeah, great Hall of Fame wide receiver.
But my favorite player growing up, all I'm and obviously still to this day, was Tom Seaver with the Mets. And I tried to, as Doug and I talked about in the book, I tried to get as much reading material as I could get on Tom Seaver. I mean, he was the All-American guy and, served in the military and was the best pitcher in baseball for New York Mets. And he was quite a person who I also got an opportunity to grow up and meet and actually be teammates with for a short period of time.
Nice. Very good choice, Roger, that's for sure. And a lot of people don't know Johnny Padres played with the Padres. I don't know if you guys knew that or not, but he was one of the original Padres. Yeah. That's a piece of trivia
for you. How about that, huh?
little useless information.
I'll tell you this, Bill. If Doug and I ever go on Jeopardy and that's a question, I'll have to make sure I thank you.
Yeah, do that. Yeah.
All right.
From the podium, yes, that would be appreciated, Roger, definitely.
And his great grandfather would have been one of the original Padres too.
Right. I mean, if you're looking for useless information, I'm your man.
Yeah.
Now in single A, double A, Roger, you were a starter. What happened that turned you into the bullpen?
Probably, I think it was more out of necessity and what I can provide. As you said, I was in the minor leagues. I mean, in my college career and my minor league career, I was a starting pitcher. It just says in the book that I made the ball club as a long reliever, mm-hmm. which usually starters are okay long relievers because they are able to eat up a few innings and therefore, at the time was an injury to Brent Gaff in spring of 85 and, they were in need of a pitcher. There's, four or five of us, I know for sure that were slated to go to AAA Tidewater at the time and be starters. And so when Brent Gaff had his injury, they looked to someone that would fill that need, and I happened to be in the lucky one that got chosen.
Hmm. Okay, yeah, interesting. There's a classic Met minor league name for you folks, Brent Gaff. There you go. Now, how did the idea for this book and really the spawn of the project come to fruition, Doug?
Well, it's quite fortunate, Bill. It was I was working on a book on the 1987 Cardinals, strangely mm-hmm. enough, and got a hold of some people in the Cardinals media relations office, and I told them I wanted to get the Mets' perspective on that season because the Mets and Cardinals had such a great rivalry and battle, you know, mid-80s through late-80s, and they put me in touch with the great Jarwitz, and Jay gave Jay a list of people I wanted to speak with, and Roger was right at the top of the list, and Roger and I just hit it off immediately. He's just great to talk to, very engaging, just tells fantastic, useful stories. And it occurred to me later on that with Roger's colorful career and personality and engaging personality, he'd make a great candidate for an autobiography. I was interested, so mm-hmm. I'll let Roger take it from there.
Hey, you know, Bill, I got to tell you this. You know, it comes at a time when everybody and their brother that was on that team wrote a book, and I was the only one that hadn't done it. And so I was like, you know what? I don't want to get left out in the cold here. So anyway, it was an opportunity to rehash 40 years of. A big part of my life of being with the Mets, coming up with the Mets, as a young player and going through the trials and tribulations of a Major League Baseball season, and or seasons, and also, you know, having won a World Series. So, coming up on this 40 year anniversary, we thought it was a pretty appropriate time for something like this to come out.
Definitely. You have some great stories to tell, Roger, and why not you? That's certainly the case, and I could see why you guys came up with this and decided to go ahead with it. Now, 1986, we got Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman on the show with us tonight. Really a season of memorable events. One that I want to talk to you about, Roger, is that game in Cincinnati when Ray Knight and Eric Davis had their little boxing match at third base. Davey lost some players in the ensuing brouhaha. And then he flip-flopped you and Jesse in right field, depending on whether it was a lefty or righty batter at the plate. Tell us about that night.
Yeah, I think, there were a couple things. I don't think many people knew that Ray Knight was a junior boxing champion for the state of Georgia. And also, there were, I think, five guys on each side thrown out. So David was always ahead of his time. He had a computer's office. And so he was always a forward-thinking manager. And Jesse and I, that's how we got our running in during batting practice, was our conditioning. While the other pitchers ran wind sprints or, poles, Jesse and I shagged in the outfield for three or four groups, whatever it was. And so that's how we got our running in. It took some time from, the outfielders. If anyone would go get a ball, Jesse and I would go get it. So from an athleticism point, Davey, would watch batting practice and see us in the outfield and saw that we had some athleticism. So I guess I think the exact phrase that Tim McCarver, necessity is the whatever.
Mother of invention.
Mother of invention. Thank you very much, Bill.
More useless information, folks.
Only if you need it on Jeffrey. And so Jesse only played right field and pitched. I got to play right field, left field, and pitch. It might have been Milner or Max Venable that hit a soft fly ball into left center field, more left field, and I was camped under it and waiting for it to come down in my glove because it would be nice to have a put out in the outfield. And so the ball was about 10 feet from my glove, and I'm staring up, and this foot steps on my foot, and Lenny crossed in front of me, put his glove up, caught the ball, and I said, "Dude," because you remember his name was Dude. I said, "Dude, what are you doing?" He goes, "Just wanted to be sure, man. Just wanted to be sure." So,
Hey, that's fielding percentage there. He wants that.
But Jesse did get it. Jesse got a fly ball. He got it put out in right field. It was off the bat of Tony Perez because Tony hit a low liner off of me right to Jesse in right field. So, looking back, it was a fun game, but also it was a game that I think because of what we had on our team, we're going to win this game, and we're going to do it so unconventionally, nobody will believe it.
Right. That's what it was. And like I said, a memorable night. And, Doug, with Roger and the 86 Mets, no shortages of topics to cover, right?
Well, no, that's for sure, Bill. And, I must say, though, to a man, I was fortunate to talk to a lot of Roger's teammates, and it's interesting when you do reach, you think you go into a topic and you think you know the topic. Like I went into this thinking, well, I know who Roger McDowell is, but of course there's so much more you learn. But one thing that was confirmed for me, whether it was Kevin Mitchell or Ray Knight or Lenny Dykstra or Wally Backman, these guys I spoke with, it was amazing to a man. Each of them said, in one way, they said the same thing. They said, Roger was known as a prankster. He loved to have fun, at the appropriate moments and all that. But when he went between the lines, he was all business. That smile, but the laughs went away. And you can see his countenance and his face on the mound. Anybody remembers Roger pitching, he remembers his, his cold stare at the bat. Just intent on doing his job, being reliable. And I think I can say for Roger, I think he prided himself on that reliability, being ready to answer the bell any given night that Davey needed him.
And the results show that. Certainly do. Now, I want to talk to you about Seinfeld, Roger. How did you become the notorious second spitter? How did you...
Bill, I'm allegedly.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Wink, nudge.
Yeah. I think it was the winter of, I don't know, 91 maybe, or 90. It might have been the winter of 90. And I had been traded to Phillies by then, but I still have relationships with, the players on the Mets. And so Pete Fernandez calls me up and says, "Hey, Rod," and she goes, "Have you seen this show, Seinfeld?" because he goes, and he didn't let me answer. He goes, have you seen the show Seinfeld? Because they want us to be on it. And he says, I have a kind of a bigger part. He says, and they have a part written for you. So I said, okay. So he goes, well, we have to, and again, this was in the winter. I think it was 90, because I think the show, that particular show was in 91. And so we went out to film in Los Angeles. Limo picks us up in the morning. We go to the set and meet everybody. And of course, Keith knew, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld because those were the circles he traveled in. And, you know, when Keith lived in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew these guys, and I got to meet them all. And Larry David said, hey, how do you like the show? And I said, yeah, I think it's great. And unbeknownst to him, I'd never seen the show. I didn't know what it was. And so, I mean, Seinfeld had only been on, I think there was like 6 or 7 or 8 pilot episodes the first year.
Yeah.
And the particular show that we shot was for their second year. And so, you know, I lied through my teeth on that one. But since then, you know, I've caught up and I've watched all this series and shows. And, you know, obviously nobody knew how iconic the show would become about nothing. And so it was fun to do. Again, got to meet everybody and spent a couple days spinning, and they took me out in the parking lot. They took me out in the back parking lot, you know, and like of the studio, and said, "Okay, we need you to go up there in the trees." They said, "Did you ever used to watch Laugh-In?" I said, "Yeah." They go, "Do you remember Artie Johnson when he parted the trees?" I said, "Yeah, I remember that." So he says, "Oh, that's what we want. When you part the trees, we want you to spit." I said, okay, I can do that. I said, no lines? He said, no, just spit. And so, you know, take one. And so they go, action. And so I part the trees and I spit. Okay, take two, take three, take five, take 10. And now they're like, I'm doing the same thing, and there's no addition. And sometimes maybe a plane flew over the car or something, and then they said, we got to do it again. So anyway, about the 20th take, I said, hey, fellas, I'm running out of spit.
Yeah.
You know, because I was actually spitting. And, you know, it's not like they said, okay, well, listen, you know, we'll take a break, or here's some gum, or here's some water, maybe, you know, get some saliva. No, they just said, okay, well, act like you're spitting. I said so.
Yeah.
That was my acting debut, Bill.
That's it. Yeah, and it worked. And geez, they even made a bobblehead of you spitting. I mean, you could tell you've made it when they make a bobblehead of you, or you've been on The Simpsons. I mean, those are the gauges of fame right there.
Yeah. That's my claim to fame is I got a head for Seinfeld, but not one for baseball.
No, that's a ripoff. Yeah, no good right there. Yeah.
No, but it was. I mean, you know, I'm very proud and honored that I was had an opportunity to be on that show. And you know, Bill, there's only two part episodes, and one was the finale, and the other one was the one Keith and I were in called The Boyfriend.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to this day, the show's still going, and it's still popular, and it's opened up to a whole new generation. So you live on, Roger, that's for sure. Roger McDowell.
Well, occasionally, Bill, I get a check for some residuals, so you know, it comes in handy. I mean, it's $13, but it's $13 is $13.
Go to McDonald's. Yeah, that's not bad. Now, Roger McDowell is with us with his co-author, Doug Feldman, the book Hotfoot. Let's talk about the wonderful world of Hotfoot. How did that grow into one of the top items and also to be the title of the book? Either one of you guys.
Doug, you want to jump in, and then I'll jump in after you?
Well, one of the first conversations Roger and I had, I told him, I said, well, gosh, Roger, I remember when I was in high school in the late 80s, you and Howard Johnson put out this instructional video on how to do that. But, and then there were questions of my high school teammates, and of course it crashed and burned, and did crashed and didn't burn, I should say. It didn't work. But I think Roger will say that Howard Hojo was his hot foot mentor, his teacher in coming over from the Tigers. Is that right, Roger?
That is correct. Yeah. I had seen, you remember baseball's only won once a week when I was, back in the, even my first few years in the big leagues, it was only on Saturday game a week with Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek.
Just talk and to so, Tony. Tony was on just before you guys.
No kidding.
No,
Tony's hello next time because, what a great man and a great Yankee. And
yeah, like I said, he introduced us kids to out-of-market players. The only time you'd see Harmon Killebrew, Frank Howard, Al Kaline was with Tony and Kurt Gowdy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to digress from hot
foot. No, that's okay. But before that, Mel Allen has a show this week in baseball, right?
Right. Twib notes.
Okay. So on that show, they always showed lighter things in baseball, and they showed the hot foot, and it was the Tigers that did it. And so now Howard Johnson's my teammate, and I said, Howard, were you with the Tigers when they did the hot foot? And he goes, yeah. And I said, do you know how to do it? And he goes, yeah. And so, like Doug said, Howard was my mentor. The fact of the matter is that Howard, because he was a platoon player, he played a lot. And me as being a reliever, I didn't pitch a lot till, the last hour of the game. And so I had more time on my hands. And so that's how, Howard presented, the rocket. I just perfected it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. And as poor the late, great Bill Robinson will attest to, it does work. And
Bill was a favorite subject of mine for the hot foot, and he was always good natured about it, and he got payback, but it was all in good fun, and it was all about just trying to make people smile and laugh and have a good time at what I think is the best office in the world. So you asked about how did it become the title of the book. I presented it to Doug in Triumph. Because everywhere I go, when I come back to New York, the only thing that they said, Roger, you got a hot foot for me or what?
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, that's okay with me. If I'm known by a hot foot, that's fine. But that's how we came up with the title of the book.
How about the upside down guy? How did that develop?
L.A. We were in Los Angeles playing the Dodgers, and on one of my many trips to masquerade stores, and they got some great ones out there, and they got some masks out there that are like movie quality. And so I went to this one particular store on Sunset Avenue, and I bet I bought 20 masks. And so that night, and again, I had seen a clip on TV, I don't know when it was, but it had to be around Halloween, about somebody dressed up as upside down and walking on their, what looked like was their hands, but it was actually their feet, and everything was basically upside down. So with the help of our equipment manager, Charlie Samuels, I stuffed the women's mask that I had, came straight from the mask store to the ballpark. And I stuffed it with some towel, and I, along with the sanitary socks, I tied it around my waist so that it would hang down, and we put the jersey on. And for whatever reason, this was in 86, and for whatever reason, equipment manager Charlie Samuels happened to have a pair of Rusty's old jersey pants in one of our crates that we carried on the road. And so those were the biggest pants available. So we used Rusty's pants, and he helped me put the sanitaries on my arms, and then the shoes on my spikes on my feet. And I walked down to the dugout, and our good late beloved friend Bill Robinson said, "Roger, you don't have a hair on your ass if you don't go out on the field." And so that was a challenge, and so they helped me step up on the dugout steps. It's two steps to the field, I believe it was. And so I stepped on the field, and that's when the this was before the game.
Yeah.
You know, 5-10 minutes before the game, and I guess they had the camera on, and it's showing on the big scoreboard or video board of me being upside down and, you know, twisting back and forth. And so I had fun with that. That's the upside down life.
That's a great one. Yeah, that's a classic. Now, we got a couple of minutes left, guys. Any events for the book coming up, The Great Hot Foot by Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman? Any upcoming events that Triumph has scheduled for you guys?
Well, we're still waiting to hear, but we will be anywhere and everywhere that Triumph puts something together so that we could get out there and, you know, greet and meet and see the fans and the people, and you know, get this book in their hands and let them hopefully enjoy a fun read, fun stories, and learn a little bit about maybe some things they didn't know about me. And I'll tell you this, Bill. This Doug Feldman is so terrific to talk to, and so easy to talk to, and when you tell him things, and I jump around a lot, as you can kind of probably tell right now, and I jump around a lot, and he's able to put those words down and make it flow, and it's, I think it worked out tremendously, but, whatever Triumph has for us, we'll be there, bells and whistles, and there's a possibility we may do something at Citi Field in, during the Subway Series.
That would be great. Yeah.
But the book's out. I mean, you know, it's released the 24th, which is, by my account, in 2 days. So, I mean, it's available for pre-order, and it will be officially out the 24th.
Wonderful. Well, Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman, it's been a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to spend some of us here at Sports Talk New York. The book, again, folks, is from Triumph. It's called Hot Foot, My Hijinks and Upside Down Life with the 1986 World Champion New York Mets. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you so much.
That's Roger McDowell and Doug Feldman, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in our very special guest, Sally Struthers, will join us. So just stick around, folks.
This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DFFM 95.9 Freeport, New York.
All right, we're back. We're back, folks, with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB Merrick, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. It's great to have you with us tonight on this gloomy, rainy Sunday here on Long Island. I hope it's nicer where you are tonight. We move onward and upward. Now, our next guest, an Emmy Award-winning actress known for her iconic role, of course, as Gloria Stivick on All in the Family, as well as numerous television and stage performances across the country that she's appeared in. She's currently starring in hilarious yet heartwarming production of The Full Monty. It's now playing out at the Gateway Playhouse in Bellport. That's until April 12th. I'm honored to welcome to the show tonight Sally Struthers. Sally, good evening.
Yes, good evening, Bill. Tell me about your radio station. You just announced that it's a sports show.
Yes, but I do branch out.
What the hell am I doing on a sports show?
I do.
I can't even toss the frisbee.
I do branch out, Sally. They let me branch out to actors, to musicians. I've had some great people on the show, like Butch Trucks from the Allman Brothers Band. But I do that, and people know me for that. So don't worry about it. We got your people out there.
Okay.
Now, you are the third guest I've welcomed to my show who shares my birthday. One of them was the great Cy Young pitcher Vida Blue. The other one was Senator Bill Bradley, the great senator from New Jersey and former New York Knickerbocker, and now Sally Struthers. We're all born on the same day, and that's just a great, meaningless piece of information.
Okay, well, we have more people born on that day. We have Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. We have
right.
one of the popes. We have Rudy Valley, and don't say who.
No, I know Rudy Valley. No, I know Sally. Now, let's talk about the show. The excitement of bringing the full Monty to Long Island audiences. Now, you've had such an incredible career in TV and film and theater. I know that you've played the role
Listen,
of Jeanette.
Listen, you've got to talk to your guy who answers the phone for you there because, oh, you're Sally Struthers. I remember you from back in the day. I said, I'm quite current.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, back in the day, like who am I?
She's no antique, what? Brian. Come on now. No, I'm scolding him as we speak, Sally. Don't worry about it. Now
I have a series on right now on Netflix with Ted Danson. We're about to start our third season.
Yes.
So I'm not somebody that everybody has to scratch their head. Oh, I remember her from 55 years ago from All in the Family.
Now, I know you've played this role of Jeanette Burmeister before, Sally. What keeps drawing you to the show? And what drew you to be part of the full Monty at the Gateway here on Long Island?
Well, I'm like a fly with a pastry in the room. I mean, an actor, why did they do a show once or five times or come to Long Island or go to Virginia? Or because they get an offer for a job.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't choose the show. The theater decided to do this show. I've done it three times previously. This is my fourth time around with this show, but it was... I mean, actors never know when their next job is going to be.
Right. Good point. Now, listeners may not know the show, Sally. What makes the Full Monty such really a fun and very unique musical?
Well, it started out as a film from Great Britain. It was mm-hmm. written by a gentleman from Texas named Terrence McNally. The Brits got a hold of it and turned it into a major motion picture. It was 30-some years ago that it came out. It was brilliant. It was hilarious and heartwarming and all those mushy things. And then somebody else got really smart and said, much later on, much, you know, 15 years ago, or let's turn it into a musical. Let's add songs. So it's been around for a while, first as a movie, and then now it became a musical, but audiences love it. It's about very much, when is there not a time when people are out of work? It's
right.
about all these guys that are steel workers at a plant in Buffalo, and the plant is closing, and one of the lead characters has got a son with an ex-wife, and he owes her alimony, and he has no money to give her, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's losing a job. Even the big boss there has lost the job. And they notice that their wives like to go down to the Chippendale show in Buffalo, where all the housewives go who have day jobs as a secretary or a JCPenney's. And they wait to spend their money and go see men pretend to strip. And so they get this idea that maybe they could do that for one night.
Mm-hmm.
But how are they going to do that? They're steel workers. They don't know anything about dancing and moving, and they're not so sure they want to show their bodies to people, but they work their way through it, and that's what the show's about.
As a sidelight, Sally, I'd like to ask you, what do you think of Long Island, and what do you enjoy doing here?
Going to various antique malls and antique stores.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you do a show, a live theater show, you have to do 8 performances a week, so there's not a lot of time to go do much except for your one day off a week. So that's what I do.
Yeah, a lot of good places out here for that. Yep.
Yep. Now, every theater across the country where I work has learned that they cannot hand me my paycheck on Thursday, which is what we actors call Job Appreciation Day, because it doesn't matter where you're working in the United States, they give theater actors their paycheck on Thursday. And my business managers learned a long time ago that if my check is handed to me, they will never see my income because I will spend it at every antique store in the area.
Yeah.
So I don't see my checks. They get mailed to Los Angeles.
Good. Good. This way they're put to good use. That's for sure, Sally. Now, what can audiences expect when they come to see the Full Monty at the Gateway?
What can they expect? They can expect a highly professional production with a live orchestra and all actors who are members of the acting union. So they've all done their due diligence as an actor, and they're all very highly talented and ready to be cast in this show. And as it gets closer and closer to the end of the show, they get wild with anticipation because they realize that they may see these guys completely 100% undressed.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Now, we went to see it yesterday. We were at the afternoon performance yesterday. It's my.
When were you going to tell me that, Bill?
Just now.
You're asking me questions like you know nothing about it, and you were there.
Well, I am going on the premise, Sally, that my listeners don't know anything about it, and we're trying to get these guys to go.
Well, then you got to be talking about what it did for you as an audience member. You tell me.
Oh, highly entertaining, highly enjoyable, funny, yet still has its sensitive and heartwarming parts. I wasn't really concerned if the guys were nude or not. Didn't really affect me that much. But that's what I got out of it. This was my first time at the Gateway, too, which it's a nice venue.
It really is. It's got a great theater. It's got 2 theaters, but one is the one you were in, and it's the biggest one. It's got 500 seats, and it's got a great-sized stage and lots of room for the actors to move around and dance and sing and talk and walk and steps to slide in and steps to slide out and me to have my piano there and... Yes, it's a wonderful theater.
Yeah, and you've performed on stages across the country. So do you prefer intimate regional theaters like the Gateway?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the hardest work of acting. If you stop somebody on the street who was a major motion picture star and ask them if they ever did theater, most of them would say, oh, no, absolutely no, I could never do that. And they're right, they probably couldn't, because when you shoot a film, you only need to know 2-3 pages of dialogue a day.
Mm-hmm.
But you find out what you're going to be shooting the next day, you look at it in your hotel room, you learn your 3 pages of lines, that takes, 5 minutes, and you go and that's what you shoot all day, those same 3 pages from every angle. And then when you're done with those, you never have to see those lines again. You're done with those, so you get to throw those away. But when you do a play that's 120 pages long, you have to know all 120 pages by memory. And you have to go on stage and do it without stopping. Nobody's going to yell, cut, let's do another take. You got to know it all. And there's a lot of actors who will not step foot on stage. So that's why I say it's the most difficult. And being the most difficult, it's surprising that it's the poorest pay.
Yeah, it
is. The most pay you usually get is if you do motion pictures. The middle pay is doing television. The poorest pay is theater. So actors don't do theater to get rich. They do it because they're artists.
Because they love it. Exactly. Now, I found that the show balances comedy, as I said, with really heartfelt moments, Sally. The legendary Sally Struthers is with us tonight on the program. What I took away from it was the lessons learned. Body acceptance, for one, being a big lesson that it teaches. What do you love most about the story, Sally?
Well, we've been over that 2-3 times now in our chit-chat so far about that it's heartwarming and it's funny and it's kind and it's sweet and it's emotional. That's all there. But why do I like doing it? Because the part I get to play is delicious, and it's one of the less stressful roles in the play. I come on for 3 pages where I get to kill, and then I'm off for 12 pages, and then I'm on for 2 pages where I kill, and then I'm off for 7 more pages. It's a really easy track for me and not stressful. And I get to say great comedy lines, and I get to play this older woman who was in show business 100 years ago, and she heard that some boys down at the old mill are putting on a show, so she pushes her piano from the house down to the mill.
Right.
To rehearse with them. And I just think it's a delightful part. So I love playing Jeanette Burmeister. She's been smoking cigarettes for 70 years, so she sounds like this.
Right. Now, Sally, you have such a devoted fan base from your stage roles, from TV, of course. Do you enjoy meeting the folks?
I've done films, too, Bill. I've done films, too.
Yes, you have. You have.
Okay.
Do you enjoy meeting the folks after performances, Sally?
No. Yes, I said no.
Okay.
I actually said no without a thought.
Okay. Can you tell me why?
I'm tired after a show.
Right.
I'm tired. We have a lot of shows here that are 2 shows a day. The
right.
last thing I want to do is to shake hands and take pictures with 50 different people that all have cell phones and or they want me to sign something. And everybody else in the show that's not famous gets to go back to their room and put their feet up, take a nap, make a meal, and I'm still out there talking to people and signing stuff. It's work.
Right.
And I'm not running for office. I don't have to shake hands.
You don't think that goes along with it, Sally?
Oh, maybe when I was younger and nicer, but now I'm old and tired, and I don't want to spend 20, 30 minutes with people outside taking pictures with their family members and their best friends and their spouses and signing 12 programs. It's a lot of work, Bill.
I'm sure it is, and I'm sure your points are valid. I would probably feel the same way. Do you have a problem signing autographs?
No, I sign them all the time, but I prefer it when it just happens in a restaurant or when I'm walking down a street that's one person who's smart enough to spy me, because a lot of people say, well, you don't look the same anymore. And I say, well, do you?
Right.
Anyway, that's fine, but when it's a bunch of people who I just gave my all for on stage, I no longer, because I'm old and crabby, feel that I owe them also an extra 30 minutes of my short time between 2 shows.
Understood. Nice, honest answer. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Now, the rehearsal process. I'm sure a lot of the folks are unfamiliar with that. What's it been like with this cast and the creative team?
Well, rehearsal's pretty much the same, no matter what show you're doing or what cast you're with. You have 2 weeks of rehearsal, and those are 10 hours a day. And then you move the show into the theater, because now all of the wonderful people that work in the theater have made it ready. The sets are up and the lights are ready, and now we have to marry each other. We have to learn where we enter and exit and what we push on and push off and don't run into this person and do this and do that. So it's an arduous process when you get to tech, because you make one step forward and then there's 2 steps back. It takes forever. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they say, it's opening night tomorrow night. Good luck, everybody. I always feel I'm not ready for opening night. And the older I get, the more I am not ready. Because memorizing lines gets harder when you're almost 80. and everybody else in the show is in their 20s and 30s, and they've got their lines by day 3 in rehearsal, and I'm on day 10 in rehearsal, and I still don't know my lines because my brain is tired.
Yep.
So it's a lot of work.
Why do you think live theater is still so important today, Sally?
Because people don't get outside anymore. People don't meet anybody anymore. People don't even come to a lot of the night shows here. They go in the daytime, maybe. But people are on their phones. They're on their computers. They live these solitary lives. And then you're out. You look across the way, and there's four teenagers sitting at a table in a restaurant, and they're not looking at each other or talking to each other. They're all on their phones with their thumbs going crazy typing stuff. Nobody knows how to talk to each other anymore. No, they don't know how to socialize. People have got to get out of their houses and be with strangers. It's a delightful experience. It should be.
Pretend like it's 1990 again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I agree 100%. Kids don't get out like we used to when we were kids. Like you say, everybody's got their face stuck in the phone. Do you have any place?
Or the computer. People just don't, children don't go outside to play. They're staring at the TV or their little iPhone when they shouldn't have one at 7 years old. It's crazy.
What exciting place are you going to go to this weekend to stare at your phone? That's basically what you ask people. Sure, you're going to Manhattan, but you're going to be walking down 7th Avenue looking at your telephone.
Yeah, well, here's what happens in the theater. Some of the cast has to go at the beginning of the show and pretend to be patrons at the Buffalo, New York, strip joint called Tony Giordano's, and it's supposed to seat about 1,000 people, and it's their version of the shows where guys get Chippendales or they get semi-undressed and stuff, and so they see what happens at the beginning of the show in the audience, and then the cast has to go at the end to cheer on the guys that are now finally putting on their own show. And opening night, the gal that I share the dressing room with is a wonderful actress, Emily Brockway. Emily came in and she said, this couple got up before the show even ended and ran out the door. And she said, I don't know if they hated the show or what. So she went and asked the people at the box office later. And the people at the box office told her that the reason people sit in the back when there's lots of seats left in the front is they want to be the first to get out of the theater, get in their car, not have trouble getting out of the parking lot and get home. And I said to Emily, and what happens when they get home? Is it someplace they've never been before? Like they're hopping on a plane and they're going to Bermuda? No, they're just going back home. But they're foregoing the curtain call and the actors bowing and applauding because they got to get home. Like, oh my God, folks, calm down.
Yeah.
We just worked our asses off for you. Could you stay an extra 5 minutes and give us some applause? You got to get to your car? Really?
That's so true, Sally, so true. They could stay there and show you guys how much they appreciated the performance, your hard work, your dedication, but instead we got to check Facebook. Right?
Yeah. Instead they got to get home. A place they've never been before.
Yeah.
Home? Really?
How unusual.
Yeah.
Now, for people who've never gone to the Gateway, which we said is a wonderful venue in Bellport, out Sunrise Highway, out east on Long Island, why should they make this their first show, Sally?
We had two fellows that were at the show last night that were personal friends of Emily Brockway, whose name I just said. You saw the show. She plays Harold's wife. She sings that wonderful song about being Harold's wife.
Right.
They do the cha-cha together. That's Emily Brockway. And she had two straight guys coming to the show last night. And she was worried that they were going to be a little squeamish about the whole show. And they actually loved it. And then they asked her if she could give them a ride to the train station after the show because they needed to get back into the city. And the train was late, and so she was visiting with them, sitting in the car, and they admitted to her, they're both about 38 years old, straight males. They'd never been to a theatrical performance before.
Wow.
And they loved it. And they said to Emily, you know that song they sing called Big Ass Rock when the guy's trying to kill himself in the car with the fumes? Can we get that song on Spotify? and we want to learn that song. And Emily says, I will find a recording of it somewhere and send it to your phone. But these are guys who had never been to the theater before. And they found out last night something they were missing.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
As if someone's on the fence, which I don't know why they'd be in the first place, coming to see the Full Monty. That is something you would say to convince people to go.
Yeah. I'm surprised. I'm sure you heard about all that scuttlebutt. Maybe you even talked about it on your show, Bill, about a couple of weeks ago when Timothy Chalamet, who grew up in a family that had a ballet studio and he was a dancer himself, and he said he could be done with for the rest of his life with ballet and opera. And, I mean, it was such a big deal that they constantly made fun of him during the Academy Awards.
Yeah.
He really had to eat dog do from that.
Terrible.
I mean, I think people need to widen their horizons. They live these very secular lives, and they just have their four friends that they play canasta with. And every year they go to the same place to go on summer vacation, and they do the same thing every weekend. And you think, there's so much out there in this world. You are living such a small life. Expose yourself to things. I don't mean go to a strip club. I mean go to an art gallery. Go see a play. Go see a musical. You don't have to spend $400 on a ticket and see a Broadway show. Regional theater is brilliant. Mm-hmm. Go to a theater in your own town or one town away from your town and see something. You're going to have a lovely time.
We just saw Spamalot in Oakdale. I mean, Long Island's got some great theater. People don't pull their heads out from you know where and try to see this stuff.
Well, they're living very small lives. They're not exposing themselves to the world and all the world has to offer. You don't have to get on a plane and fly to Paris. Just within the parameters of the town you live in or a few towns circumference or within your state. There are so many things to do, from going somewhere and taking a beautiful hike through the woods to seeing a waterfall to joining a bowling team to making sure you go to the movies in a movie theater once a month. Open it up. Live a little.
What do you enjoy about your show with Ted Danson, Sally?
Oh, God, just saying all that wonderful dialogue and me seeming to be current. I'm so tired of people that stop me on the street and say, oh, we miss you on television, dear. You retired.
Yeah.
I said, no, I've never stopped working. Oh, well, we haven't seen you. I said, well, first of all, I have a series on with Ted Danson, which I've done 2 years of already. And I do this and I do that, and I do regional theater all over the country. Oh, well, we don't go to the theater.
Yeah.
I said, but you are assuming that I'm retired, and you couldn't be more wrong. I work probably 10 months of every year. I own a home in Los Angeles, and I never get to be in it because I'm always somewhere working. So don't assume I'm retired. It's insulting.
I agree, Sally. Yeah, keep going. Just want to ask you, final question, favorite episode of All in the Family?
Sammy Davis.
Yeah. So many people say that. That's a classic.
I say it because it was the longest recorded live audience laughter that ever happened on television.
People may
the
not know that.
The audience laughed louder and longer when Sammy kissed Archie on the cheek than any television audience has ever left. And that's something. And plus, I got to make friends with Sammy Davis and remain friends with him until the day he died.
Very valuable and very invaluable thing, Sally, definitely. One of my favorite character actors of all time, I watch him on Leave It to Beaver. I watch him on Andy Griffith. Burt Mustin. Can you tell me what...
Oh, God, I love Burt Mustin when he played the couple that came over to our house and they had to admit they were living together because it was more financially correct to live together than to get married, because if they got married, they would have less money to live on.
Right.
Yeah, I love that. And Burt Mustin, he was celebrating... He had just celebrated his 90th birthday when he worked with us, and he was sitting there talking to Rob Reiner and me. I just celebrated my 90th birthday last week, and Rob said, oh, did you have a party? Oh, no, I don't go to parties. I don't have parties. Oh, well, did you at least, you know, have a little glass of bubbly and cake? Oh, no, I don't drink, never have. I don't eat sweets. And Rob asked him a few more questions, and everything was known. And then Burt said, and I just celebrated my 90th birthday, and Rob said, how? How did you celebrate your birthday? You don't eat cake. You don't have a glass of champagne. You don't go out. You don't have people over. What was your celebration?
Yeah.
That was funny.
What did he say? Did he say anything?
He just laughed.
Yeah.
He was such a delightful man.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed his work. As I said, he shows up in so many television shows. It's unbelievable.
And most of America, and certain your listeners, don't know who we're talking about. But if you have a cell phone, just say his name into the cell phone. Say, I'd like some images of actor Burt Mustin. And they'll see him and they'll go, oh, I remember that guy.
Right, like Charles Lane is another guy. You know who Charles Lane is, Sally?
I do not.
Oh, well, if you get a chance, Google him. You'll know who he is once you see him. He plays an old curmudgeonly type guy in every show he's in. He was in It's a Wonderful Life, been in so many things, but you'll recognize him when you see him. But, Sally, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time. It's been an honor and a pleasure talking to such a legend.
I'm not a legend. I'm just a working actor. I want to thank you for coming to Gateway and for seeing the show. We so appreciate it. Who did you bring with you?
My wife.
What did she think?
Oh, she loved it, too. Yeah, we both enjoyed it.
Give her my love.
I will, Sally. Sally's in the Full Monty now through April 12th out at the Gateway in Bellport. For more information and tickets, visit thegateway.org, all one word, thegateway.org. Thanks again, Sally, for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us. All the best for the rest of the way, and please come back to Long Island soon.
Thank you, Bill Donahue. Thank you so much.
That's Sally Struthers, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in former NBA star Mel Counts. Stick around, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB Radio. Here in Merrick, Long Island, New York, USA, North America, planet Earth, Milky Way Galaxy. So if anybody has any doubts where we are, there you go. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Sally Struthers. A little nervous, talking to such a legend as she is. She is a legend, I think, but we'll leave that up to you folks to decide. Either way, we're glad to have you aboard tonight. Our next guest, a former NBA center, He had a distinguished career at Oregon State, won a gold medal with the United States at the 64 Olympic Games, and a two-time NBA champion. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Mel Counts. Mel, good evening.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you giving me a buzz.
No worries, Mel. I remember you as a kid and always enjoyed your game. Of course, grew up with the Knicks and the 69-70 season, that tremendous finals against the Knicks and the Lakers. Just so memorable with Willis and Clyde, Wilt, Jerry West. Unbelievable. And
well, I thought that year the Knicks, to my estimation, had one of the more high IQ, intelligent teams, players. They were very smart.
Yeah, and I think that that's a tribute to Red Holtzman, the coach, and maybe some of the Rhodes Scholarship from Dollar Bill rubbed off on them. We were just talking to I talked to Sally Struthers from All in the Family about she shares the same birthday as I, and Bill Bradley, who I've had on the show before. And just an example, Mel, of, and I told him so, an example of a life well lived. I mean, winning, I believe they won gold as well in the Olympics. He was he on your team?
Yep, we're on the same team together.
Right, so he won gold. He went on to win two championships with the Knicks. Of course, a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford in England, and a United States Senator.
Yeah, what a distinguished career.
Not too shabby, right?
Right.
Well, I want to ask you, Mel, who were your heroes when you were a kid? Your teams, doesn't have to be basketball. It could be any sport. Some of your heroes when you were a kid.
Well, I think Bill Russell, because I remember I was in the eighth grade and I was listening to them on their radio, and they were playing. I think they might have been playing Oregon State at one time, and he was such a great player. And then people like Bob Feller. And I was a Dodger fan, because back in the sixth grade I had a real creative, innovative teacher, and he allowed us to listen on the radio in the sixth grade the World Series between the Brooklyn Dodgers and New York Yankees. And for some reason I took a liking to the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. And I've been a fan ever since. But it was back then, we didn't have TV, we had a radio, so it really made your mind pretty darn creative and use your imagination.
That is the theater of the mind. I forget who coined that expression, Mel, but that's what radio is called, the theater of the mind. And the broadcaster, that's what I hope to do with people. I hope to paint the picture for them and give them a bird's eye view of what's going on with my guest and myself. And that's what that's what I hope.
I think you make a lot more clarity that way than watching TV.
Yeah.
Just different sports figures, and then my sixth grade teacher. I needed a mentor and a role model at that time in my life, and he was it. And people like that. I guess there's more people, just everyday people, than any celebrities or sports figures.
Mm-hmm.
Neighbors I had and friends I had, and I think that it was a blessing then that they filled in for me. And so it wasn't exactly, sports figures or celebrities.
Right. You're fortunate to meet people like that, memorable people, Mel. Definitely.
Yeah.
Very fortunate. Now, I want to ask you about your college career as an Oregon State Beaver. Talk to us a little bit about your college career.
Well, when I was in high school down at Marshfield, it's down the coast in Oregon. Oregon State started recruiting me when I was a sophomore, so I started coming up to games. And the coach last still, my senior year was his last year. He coached there 36 years. He was a legend at Oregon State in Oregon. And at one time, he was in the top four or five for our winning college programs. And Slats was an interesting character because, you got to be very careful what you did, because otherwise you'd be in his room for about an hour and he'd be talking to you, and he had famous things like, don't be looking out the window, don't be a locker room attorney, no big bad mouth with another guy. And the thing that really helped me in the pro basketball, because in high school and college, I was always a star. Mm-hmm. Well, in 12 years in the NBA, I was a substitute. But he back lectured everybody. He says, you know, it's really easy to be a star. You know, your job to get the rebounds, make everybody else better, win the games. He says, the toughest role in basketball is the role of a substitute. He says, if you're number 9 on the team or number 10, don't be backbiting people. Hey, just work harder, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those words paid off because that's what I was. You know, I was an average role player. I lasted 12 years. I did my job, and I was a sub.
Right, and you really were prepped for that role.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had about 5 or 6 really good years, actually with the Lakers. I got to thinking about the other day, and actually I was in the final 6 times, and 4 times with the Lakers we didn't win it, but then 2 times with the Celtics we did, and so it's a big deal. You know, it's real pleasant memories, good memories.
We're talking to Mel Counts tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, the 64 summer games, as we mentioned, Bill Bradley on the team. How was that experience in the Olympic Games that year, Mel?
Well, we went over to Pearl Harbor. Of course, Hank Iba from Oklahoma State, he was our coach.
Legend.
Taskmaster. We went over to Pearl Harbor, and we worked out 2.5 hours in the morning, 2.5 hours in the evening. And we did that for 2.5 weeks. And it was a bittersweet victory because a lot of sports writers didn't think we were going to win. I don't know if the coach thought we were going to win, but he instilled confidence in us. And so when we went over there, we were ready to play mentally and physically. And so I tell you, the MVP, I thought the MVP of our team was our coach. We didn't have any outstanding superstars. You know, we had Bill Bradley and had Larry Brown and Joe Caldwell, Jerry Shipp, and Lucius Jackson and George Wilson and a few other players myself. But we just clicked together. He molded us together. We had the chemistry, and we were ready to play. And I remember one time we played in the morning over there, and that afternoon we got out and we worked out again. But I give him all the credit in the world, the coach.
Hank Iba, yeah, as I said, a legend in U.S. basketball, definitely. Now, Mel, you were drafted by the Boston Celtics. You won NBA championships in 65, 66. You were Bill Russell's backup. Now, I could think of worse jobs to have, but you must have went up, right? I bet you went up against him in practice, so you must have learned.
Well, he didn't practice.
Oh, no?
No, he didn't practice.
Oh, boy.
Well, he played 48 minutes a game.
Yeah.
And actually, there were times I played in the same time with him in games because I could shoot the outside jumper. And I don't know if anybody talked about the amount of money we made back then, but my first year, I made $12,000 and another $3,400 for winning it all. And the most I've ever made the NBA is $80,000. I'm not complaining. The players that get now, that's fine. I don't have any problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't trade that. I still go back and play what I did for what I made. And it was a great life. I went to every state, got to go to other countries just because of playing basketball.
Did you learn anything from Bill Russell?
Well, I learned that he was his whole goal was to. He looked at different players and said, well, how can I make them better in order for us to be successful? Of course, blocking shots, rebounding, you know, doing the dirty work. Going in there and doing the dirty work and then helping his playmates to be successful. Instead of me, it was we. And I think that I learned that from him. And he was really had a high basketball intelligence. And he came to play. He came to play every game.
Now you were traded from the Lakers to the Baltimore Bullets, who were then known as the Baltimore Bullets. Kids, they're the Washington Wizards now. But, of course, the Bullets have evil connotations, so we had to change that name. right? And was Wesley Unseld on that team with you, Mel?
No, he wasn't. I've got to tell you about this trade because
go ahead.
I had my little son, and he, in fact, he learned how to stand up going on that trip. We got to Seneca, New York, and I called my roommate, John Thompson. He says, "Have you heard? You've been traded." I said, "No, I didn't know that." And of course, back then we didn't have cell phones, so I called the Celtics and I called Baltimore. And we didn't get together on a contract, so I turned around my car. Of course, I'd already gone up almost 3,000 miles. Turned around, went back to Oregon, and stayed there for a couple weeks. And turned around, went back to went to Baltimore. So went about 6,000 miles in about 3 weeks.
Yeah, pretty productive, right?
In fact, I to be honest with you, I was thinking about quitting, but my mother-in-law said, "You know, you shouldn't quit. My husband has been working all his life, and he's a superintendent of school. He's only making $11,400, you know." And so I thought, well, that makes sense, you know, because, I mean, who wants to go from a championship team to a team that's not that good? And they were not that good, the Baltimore Bullets, at that time.
No. And at least they dealt you to the Lakers, who were a playoff caliber team, and you got some modicum of success there.
Well, yeah, that I probably played my best when I was with the Lakers. Got an opportunity to you've got to put the time in, and I think probably a lot of athletes you've interviewed have stated that if you don't play, they don't know how good you are, what you can do, and had my opportunity there and made the best of it, and I feel real blessed and fortunate to have been there during that time and playing with Elgin Baylor and Jerry West and eventually with Wilt Chamberlain.
How was it playing with Wilt? Now, did he practice at all, Mel?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay. I got a story about here, too. So we're playing New York, and this is when Walt Bellamy was there with the first half, I was in the game plan and everything, but Willis was beaten on one side of Wilt, and then Walt Bellamy was beaten on the other side. Now Willis was about 6'9", 240, 245, and Bellamy was 6'11", 265. And so they're pretty stout guys, and they're just hammering on both arms and legs and everything. And so I was sitting there in the second half, and I thought, what's going to happen this second half? Pretty soon they started doing that. When they were hanging on to him, Wilt lifted him off the ground and threw him in different directions. That's how strong he was. he was unbelievable. I mean, he could bench, I think, 5'5", 50 like that. And for a guy that had a 44-inch arm reach, you know, that's unbelievable.
Yeah,
that's
tough.
He was super strong. And the other thing I got to give him credit for, he allowed me to play forward when I was there. I didn't particularly always back him up. And then my second time I came there, I wasn't playing much. So Wilt went to Bill Sharman and said, "Hey, I need some help rebounding. I need to have talents in the game." And that's how I got to play, because he said, because I was, halfway decent rebound. And so I give him a lot of credit all in the world, he's probably one of the greatest athletes ever.
Yeah.
Because his track skills, too. You know, he was something else. But, and then all the records he holds, as far as points and rebounds and all this stuff. And they didn't keep block shots in, but I remember one time, Twyman was interviewing Wilt, saying, he said something not being very coachable, this and that. And I think that game, he went out and either 22 or 24 block shots he got. I mean, he just tore people up,
Yeah.
Now he could play today with ease. I mean, he's strong.
Yeah. Wilt was in a class by himself. Unfortunately, guys like Wilt, even Kareem, they get forgotten today and lost in the way the game is played today. Go ahead, Mel. I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you. I think they forget how great these players in the past, Jerry West, Oscar Robertson, Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, these guys were, I think we only think about the recent past, like the Bird era, and then the present. And these other guys need credit for the way they played and how they kept the NBA alive.
Yeah, no, exactly. And unfortunately, as we said, they get forgotten today. Mel Counts with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Those Laker teams, it had to be easy playing for them, Mel.
Well, yeah, when you're playing with superstars, it makes you that much better because a lot of attention is on them, you know, and yet you're able to slip in there and score some baskets, rebound, but they elevate your play. And that's where I was very fortunate, blessed to be on those teams that elevated my play because, when you're playing with a Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, and Will Chamberlain, that's pretty good stuff.
Yeah. You had a good jump shot for a guy that's 7 foot, Mel.
Yeah.
To what do you attribute your good outside shooting?
Like anybody else practice. I wish I'd have practiced more like the athletes now. They're unbelievable, the time they put in. Well, back then, you need a steak before the game. No, it doesn't digest. No, it's nutrition. You got these players hiring trainers, hiring nutritionists, and prolonging their career, making them better players. And all these drills are like, I've watched Pete Maravich drills, I've watched Curry drills, and we never did that back then. And so they're so much better now. They're bigger, they're stronger. I don't know if they're any more fun. And the game is more up-tempo. It's a more up-tempo game. You know, when I was with the Celtics, I think they played pretty much up-tempo. You know, we went into the training camp. The first 3 days, you never shot the basketball. All you did was exercise. Run, push-ups and bend-ups and all kinds of stuff. And about the fourth day, you got to start shooting the basketball.
I know you played for Butch Van Bredekhoff, Mel. Who would you consider the best coach that you played for?
Well, I'd probably have to say Red Auerbach. The reason I say Red Auerbach was he had a knack of drafting players and also getting players that maybe had a year or two left. Like he traded me for Bailey Howell. Bailey Howell was an all-star, and he helped him win a championship. Wayne Embry, he brought him in, and I think he only played one or two more years. And he just had a knack for doing that in the sixth man. I know a lot of teams or people hate him, like we went to Philadelphia. My golly, six, because he let up that stogie, when he thought the victory was in hand. And we went to Philadelphia. They started throwing cans of beer at us, cigars, garbage. We had to get out of it because he irritated people.
Yeah. A legend, but the irritating.
He knew his stuff. I give him all the credit in the world. He knew his stuff and how to motivate players. And of course, he had surrounded by, first of all, Bill Russell. That didn't hurt you at all. And then he gathered from there.
Yeah, no, it never hurts to have Bill on your team, right, Mel?
No.
We just spoke about a guy who gets lost today, too, is Pistol Pete. I mean, you don't hear anything about the guy, and he was an amazing talent back then.
Well, he was ahead of his time. I played with him for a couple of years, and he had incredible drills, and it was a good guy. Really, he died really young.
Right.
But he paid the price. He just worked, and just showed you what you can do is you put the time in.
Right.
And speaking of time, I've got to tell you a story. I was with the Lakers, and we had five straight games in five different cities. After the third or fourth night, I had to look out the window to see where we were, and I looked across the street and it said Cleveland Bar, and I said, we're in Ohio. And the thing about that, we called ourselves, I think we won all five games. We played some tough teams, and we played the Milwaukee, and I forget who else, but we played some tough teams, and we called ourselves the Magnificent Seven because there's only seven players playing it. The rest of everybody else is injured. And that's when Jerry West kind of carried the load, But I'll never forget that. Five straight games and five, and sometimes you get up at 5 a.m. and it gets the flight to play that night. And that's just the way it was. And, you didn't complain, just went and did it.
And as you said, Mel, conditioning. Conditioning was key.
Conditioning. You're talking about the Knicks. We used to go there and play in Boston, and it was one of those deals where, on a Sunday, all the theaters are letting out, and all the things that are happening are letting out. And so Red Auerbach says, okay, guys, he says, I want you to get to the airport, every man for himself. In other words, we had to get our, back then, had to get our own cab, you know.
Wow.
And of course,
yeah.
That all changed as anything got busted, you know, which made more sense. But you had to go down, you had to hail a cab, and that was your job, your responsibility to get to the airport.
Wow. Yeah.
You know?
They didn't give you much of a break, did they?
No, that's what it was. And then we always, up until about my, sixth or seventh year, we always flew second class. And of course, you know, you got 6'8", 6'10", 7-foot guys in the back, you know, that's pretty tight back there.
Yeah, I'll say.
They got charter planes, don't they? All a lot of teams got charters.
Yeah,
right.
Everybody goes, excuse me, everybody goes on the charter plane. And makes it a lot easier.
So speaking, I got another story for you. When I was in Baltimore, Buddy Jeanette was the general manager, coach, I guess. And anyway, he chartered this plane. And it was a plane that was only two prop, and the plane would only hold about 14 or 15 people. So we take off, and we're going to play in Indiana. Where did Jerry Sloan? What was his college town he played in? It was about a 900-mile ride. Anyway, the plane.
I know. He played for the Bulls. I don't know where he went to school.
No, he played in Evansville. He played in Evansville.
We went
to Evansville to play an exhibition game. So we get up in the air, and we have to land because it doesn't hold enough fuel to get us 900 miles. So we land. We fill it up with fuel. We get up in the air, and I'm not kidding you. Lightning hit. We were dropping 200 feet. We were raising 500 feet. We were going sideways. You know, it was like that one series, the inner sanctum, you know, where you saw this, all this crazy stuff going on. So when we landed to the man, we said, we're not going back tonight. And Buddy Jeanette said, he said, you're defeating our purpose. In other words, you got a good deal on the plane, but the hell with the player as far as living or not.
Yeah.
So we went back the next day. We get up in the air, and it's a nice day, and we land, and the co-pilot had one eye, and he's out there with a screwdriver and his wrench working on the engine. I thought, geez, you know, that's a vote of confidence. Are we sure we want to stay on this plane? But I guess he fixed whatever needed to be fixed on the engine, and we got back up and left. That was a hairy experience, I tell you. Geez.
Yeah, you're lucky you didn't see him with a roll of duct tape, too, Mel. You know.
Right.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. But that's the way it was back then. You toughed it out, you know, and you did what you had to do. And I think the guys, for the most part, played for the love of the game because a lot of guys had second jobs because some guys were making $6,500, $8,500. And I remember when Russell went in and asked for a $1 raise, he wanted to make a dollar more than Chamberlain, so he asked for $100,001. And back then, that was, you know, that was top money in basketball.
Yeah.
And it's nothing now. But I don't know. I don't even know what the average salary is now, but it's right up there, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's quite a bit more than $100,000, Mel. That's for sure. Now, who would you consider your best teammate through your storied career?
Well, I liked Paul Silas and John Egan and those were probably John Thompson. I like John Thompson, of course. You know how he found out, another story, how he found out he wasn't on the team anymore? He comes in the locker room, and I think it was his second year, and looks up at his hanger, where his uniform was hanging.
Yeah.
He says, well, I guess I'm not on the team anymore. That's how he found out. But it was different back then. It was so much different, you know. But then he went on, Georgetown won a national championship, and got a lot of notoriety, coached on a couple of Olympic teams, so he was very successful later on.
Oh yeah, he was no slouch, Coach Thompson, that's for sure.
No.
How about your biggest thrill, Mel? Your biggest thrill throughout your career?
Gold medal.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Even over the world champion, the gold medal, and like I said, it was bittersweet because a lot of writers said we weren't going to win. We didn't have any outstanding star, and like I said, I thought Hank Edwards was our MVP, and it was a big deal then, but the bigger deal now, knowing that you represent your country, and you go over there, and you get it done, and I'm very proud of that, and I know some players that sold their gold medals, but I would never do that. I would pass it on to my kids.
Yeah. No, I would hang on to mine, too. It's such a great honor, and we just saw that with the hockey teams, the three U.S. hockey teams winning gold, bringing it home to the American people, as you said. And today, the audience is just so much larger than it was back in 1964. Crazy popular, all these people. They come back to endorsements and really American heroes, and it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that because I played with a guy in college that was a decathlete. In fact, his senior year, he was a national champion decathlete, but he couldn't go older because he didn't have a sponsor. And so he saw us as well. Okay, he went to dental school, and then he became very successful in doing that. But he was a great athlete. In fact, his senior in high school, he was a national high hurdle champion, and Mel Renfrow, who was a famous football player for Dallas, he was a national low hurdle champion. And so we had a lot of. In fact, when I went to college, there were a lot of players doubled up. They either played track and basketball or baseball and basketball. Mm-hmm. And Terry Baker, he came to Oregon State on a basketball scholarship. Tom Prokop said, well, we'd like to have you come off of football. Well, the rest is history, because his senior year, he won the Heisman Trophy in 1963.
Amazing. Well, Mel, thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us here in New York.
I appreciate talking to you, and I wish you well. Like I say, I feel very blessed. Everything's gone on, and I feel very fortunate, and I wish everybody well.
You too, Mel. All the best. That's Mel Counts, okay. Ladies and gentlemen.
You're welcome.
That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Tony Kubek, Roger McDowell, and Doug Feldman, Sally Struthers, and Mel Counts, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. See you next on Sunday, April 5th, Easter Sunday, for more Sports Talk New York, when we welcome in Trader Jack McKeon, amongst others. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.